Doesn't that sound fantastic? Pianist Ralph Vodopek, live from Studio S here at WKAR's Current State. He is playing Current State's brand new, or I should say newly refurbished, newly restored, 1936 Steinway Model S piano, which just made its way into our studio here a week or so ago, and we can't think of a better way for you to hear it the first time for anybody other than Ralph Vodopek to be playing. And we'll be hearing more from Ralph Vodopek throughout the hour today. He's got a very important performance coming up that we want to tell you about as well. We're glad you're along here for Current State here for Friday. Later this hour, cinematographer Dan Neese, who's a master of the Steadicam. You've probably seen his work in a number of movies. We'll talk with Dan. He's in East Lansing this weekend. Also, Michigan State School Board President John Austin on the Education Achievement Authority coming up later on Current State. At the top of our program, in the Holt School District, students, families, and other stakeholders have been embroiled in a debate over changes in the district. Recently, a dispute over a district reinvention plan has intensified. Opponents of the plan now threaten to replace members of the Holt School Board, which approved it. Like so many school districts, Holt's been hit hard by state funding cuts, dwindling property tax revenue, as well as a drop in enrollment. The plan, as it's come to be known, aims to avoid cuts to programs through a series of moves. Lately, the focus of the controversy has been the decision to move Holt High School seniors to a building that currently serves only freshmen. The ninth graders will swap places, joining sophomores and juniors at Holt High School this fall. We're now joined by guests on opposite sides of the issue. First, we want to welcome Holt School Superintendent Dr. Johnny Scott. Welcome to Current State.
Good morning.
And an opponent of the switch, as it's come to be called, Dr. Larry Nassar, who has three children attending Holt Public Schools. Hi, Dr. Nassar.
Good morning.
Johnny Scott, can you, as briefly as possible, just tick through the reasons why it's a good idea to switch ninth graders and seniors in Holt?
Well, as we approached this reinvention plan, we looked at this as an opportunity for us to move our ninth graders earlier into the high school and emphasize the importance of that, which also will give those students opportunities to receive acceleration for content courses, as well as to allow us to be more efficient with streamlining our resources to struggling learners as well. As far as the seniors is concerned, we want to create an experience for seniors that will prepare them for life beyond school. And a separate campus will allow us the flexibility to include things like a cottage-like setting, encouraging time management, self-directed learning skills. And we want to build these experiences with that emphasize both soft skills like presentation, communication, helping students understand their roles during lecture, discussion, group work. And these types of experiences will be embedded in capstone courses, you know, sometimes referred to as pathways, and or job shadowing opportunities that we're looking forward to creating with local businesses. And it's difficult to create these types of experiences and sustain them in a traditional bell-driven, rule-regulated schedule of a 9-12 traditional high school. So that is our rationale in a nutshell.
And Larry Nassar, if you could respond, please, why do you and others tend to oppose the switch?
Well, we don't oppose the whole plan because I think that there's some wonderful things that Dr. Scott and the administration is trying to do to enhance the education of our schools. The main issue is, as the switch, as we discuss it, is that we cannot figure out why that form of teaching cannot be done in a separate wing of the school. Since the high school is beautiful, it's really designed for all of these educational advances when they built it, so that there's separate wings, so that the senior class could actually be a senior wing in the school and have a separate outdoor access to the parking lot, and they could come and go there and have their own bell system or no bells. Everything that can be done in the school across the way, we feel can be done in the high school. And since there's very little evidence that's out there that supports a separate 12th grade class in a separate building that shows the benefits of it, there's very little of that compared to the volume of research and the volume of information that says a separate 9th grade class actually enhances retention in school actually chances the kids to do better in grades. So the research that's out there literally is overwhelming for that comparatively to the 12th grade system.
Dr. Scott points out, though, that there are advantages there are also some advantages to be gained if the 12th graders have their own place. There are certain opportunities that they're trying to make available to them. Do you doubt that, or do you simply feel that 9th graders need a space of their own more than 12th graders?
Well, in the arrangement right now, the 12th graders could be kept in the high school and yet kept in a separate wing. As a matter of fact, I believe one of the things that they're thinking about doing is when the 9th graders, Dr. Scott, you can correct me, but if the 9th graders move over to the high school, they will be placed in a separate wing to keep them, as you say, in separate groups within the high school itself.
Go ahead and respond to that.
A correction is that what we're going to do is group the kids, the 9th graders, in small learning communities, which means that their four core courses, math, science, social studies, will be contiguous so that those kids, instead of having to move across the whole school, will move in small contiguous communities. So it's not going to be a wing per se. It's going to be we're going to group kids in a small learning community, which is also one of the benefits that the research for these separate campuses have figured out, that a standalone campus allows that, but it's the grouping of kids that really accentuates the benefits. And so we're going to take some of the things that we've learned and just suppose though in the high school as well too.
I am told there was, and there may still be, compelling research to create a separate building for ninth graders. I mean, when the separate ninth grade building was created in Holt, that was apparently part of the justification. Is that no longer relevant?
No. When we created the ninth grade campus, that was 10 years ago. And I would remind people that 10 years ago, we didn't have iPads, iPods. And so it's not like we want to say that the ninth grade campus setting is bad. We're simply saying that we can gain from that. There are some experiences and advantages that we want to just suppose those. But this move is part of a larger comprehensive move for Holt schools to try to make sure that we balance academic attainment with the notion of dwindling resources, and how can we do that in an efficient manner and continue to provide opportunities and services for kids.
I know some resistance to the switch stems from safety concerns. Larry, do you have any of those?
Well, you know, they are doing a study. Dr. Scott has asked for a study to be done on the traffic patterns. And the only issue with that is that right now the concern is at Holt Road and Carnes, where there's a traffic light and where the turning goes in and out of the high school. However, with the switch situation, where the high school seniors will be driving their cars is in a separate parking lot where there is no traffic light. There's two entrances and exits from that parking lot, and there are no stoplights. So that if you analyze the traffic pattern now, that'll completely change. And we're like, why isn't there a blinking light or some type of way that during the school day they could have better access in and out of the parking lot? With the new configuration where the seniors will be going to the ninth grade and the ninth grade will be going to the 12th grade, you really need to look at that situation, because it is basically there is no stoplights for those seniors in their cars to be coming and going from that building.
Dr. Scott, are you comfortable about the safety issue in general? Do you feel like it will be addressed, or
well,
it has been
that
addressed?
That is something that has repeatedly been raised by Dr. Nasser and some of his peers, and we acknowledge that is an issue, and as he said, that we are looking at that. So we, you know, the verdict is still out on that. We are trying to get some evidence of that, and we will continue to do that.
Larry Nasser, I have to point out, I mean, the board, I want to make clear to our listeners, the board's approved the plan. Mm-hmm. The administration appears to be emphasizing it is moving forward with the plan. Right. Where does that leave you and the others who oppose this?
Well, you know, it's one thing to say that we approve of a plan. It's another thing to implement the plan. So there's not that much discussion about the plan. It's more about how it's being implemented, because when you look at the way that it's been implemented, it has really been poorly communicated to the people. So it's hard for people to understand. Just like Dr. Scott just said, we don't have the answer yet about the safety. We're still working on it. You ask them about the way that they're implementing some of the educational changes. The The questions that the students and parents have been asking, the response has been continually, we are still working that out. In their remarks about the lateness, in other words, when you transfer from the junior high school, or not the junior, I'm sorry, the ninth grade campus to the 12th grade campus, there is a 10-minute delay. So when the kids currently, which we need to fix, when the kids currently switch over, the ninth graders go on the first and sixth hour. They're allowed to take a bus, and on first hour and sixth hour, the ninth graders can transfer over to the high school. And according to the Reinventing Hope website, right on their website, it says the students are routinely 10 minutes late for their class. So they are trying to work out a bell system or changing so that students do not lose seat time in the class. So currently, the school actually has a system set up for kids to lose time when they transfer from first and sixth hour, and it's been acceptable. And we're asking, why is that acceptable? So if our seniors now are in the ninth grade building, and they're going to be transferring back and forth now at least first, fourth, and sixth hour, that's 10 minutes of class time that they're missing 3 hours a day, okay? And so they still cannot answer the question, why? What are they going to do about that? So they're not prepared for that. They're not prepared for the safety. What about kids in wheelchairs and mental disabilities for that transfer back and forth? How long is it going to take them to go from the one building to the other building? Now, yes, currently they have it with ninth graders, but it's only for two, like for choir and band. But with the seniors, they'll be going for real classes. And so with these kids with disabilities, how difficult is it for them? Or are they just going to be restricted from being able to go back and forth because of loss of seat time in class?
Dr. Johnny Scott, do you feel like you're behind in the planning for this transition?
No, we don't. We've been looking at this plan for over 3 years. In April of 2013, we initially proposed this plan to our community, and with the reaction of the community asked us to wait a year. So we did wait a year. We continued to plan, and now we're ready to implement. So there will always be nuances of any type of innovation. We understand that. We know where we're going to learn as we go. Do we have all the answers to everything? No. We're going to work through some of those answers. But we feel that we've been responsive to the concerns that parents have raised. We've looked at those concerns. We've included those. And actually, they have been helpful to us really looking at the nuances of how we will implement the plan. So I want to say thank you, and we continue to solicit and listen to those voices.
You're not reconsidering delaying the plan, though, correct?
That's correct.
It will be implemented this fall. Larry Nassar, several people have commented to me that this current board, several members of which now may face election challenges, has enjoyed pretty good marks in the community in the past. Is this issue worthy of an overhaul of the school board?
Well, again, it's not a matter of what was done in the past. It's great. But when you're trying to reinvent a school system and the way that you implement it and the way that you sort of like go against the trust of the people, because when you have evidence that shows that, for the student standpoint, 200 students had a sit-in in January to say, we don't want this. We have a petition of 889 parents that says, we don't want this. We have a survey by the Holt Education Association that says two-thirds of the teachers do not want this. This is as of January, okay? And now it's February, and they're still saying, okay, two-thirds of the teachers, the majority of the students, by any way that we can survey the parents, the majority of the parents are against the switch. And the board and the administration just keep saying we're moving forward and not addressing these concerns to say, well, wait a second, maybe there is something that we need to slow down. Maybe we need to figure this out more. As Dr. Scott just said, he appreciates the things that we have been showing him because it says, wow, we didn't think about that. And the way that they're trying to distribute their information, if you go to their website, on the Hope Public School website, for notifications, the page is blank. For press releases, the page is blank. For notifications to students, resources, the page is blank. So there's blank page after blank page after blank page on their Hope Public School website. Now, they did set up a volunteer website called Holt and Reinventing Holt, but there's no link on Reinventing Holt even to go back to the Hope Public School website. And in addition, about the capstone courses, which is a major change in education, there's one word of capstone And there's no, like, there's no explanation of how Capstone is on their websites.
We have to conclude. We're nearing the end here, unfortunately. Dr. Scott, there is noticeable resistance to the plan. Are you confident you'll be able to work through all of these?
Yes, we are. And I would just like to, for clarification, when he says the majority, he said 240 students. We currently have 1,300 students in our high school. He said two-thirds of the teaching staff. I want to make sure that a correction is that our teacher association addressed the board and Mr. Nasher to say that that survey that they did was part of their negotiation strategy, had nothing to do with trying to take a position on this issue, and they don't have a position. So I just caution that when we say majority, we really need to kind of explore that a lot more fullier.
We have to leave it there. We want to thank both of our guests who are on opposite sides of a plan to reinvent Holt Schools here, on opposite sides of the switch, as it's being called. Dr. Johnny Scott is the superintendent of Holt Public Schools. Larry Nassar has three children attending the Holt Public Schools. Thanks to both of you. Good luck.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Pianist Ralph Votopek live from Studio S here at WKAR, performing on our brand new piano here in the Current State Studios. We talk with Ralph Votopek here in just a little bit about an upcoming performance. Cinematographer Dan Neese has had a long career in movie making, commercials, and music videos. He learned how to handle a Steadicam from its inventor, Garrett Brown, and has a track record of nearly three decades that earned him the Steadicam Guild's first ever Lifetime Achievement Award. His film credits include working on David Lynch films like Blue Velvet, Wild at Heart, and Mulholland Drive, along with Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown. This afternoon, Dan is conducting a cinematography workshop for MSU Film Studies students here at WKAR. His visit to Michigan State was arranged by the MSU College of Arts and Letters, sponsors of the Global Film Series. Dan Neese, welcome to Current State.
Hi.
Tell us what a Steadicam is. What does it do? How does it work?
A Steadicam is a body-mounted camera stabilizer. It consists of a vest, mechanical arm with titanium springs in it, and a pendulum mounted in a gimbal. The camera mounts on one end of the pendulum, and the other end is batteries and a video monitor.
And what does it enable a cameraman, a video, a cinematographer to do? How did it change things in the movie world?
Well, there's several ways that it changed things. The way that it works is it takes the center of gravity from inside the camera and moves it down below the gimbal, which is a part of the Steadicam, what we call the sled, which is where you can put your hand on it so you can access it. Then the mechanical arm separates your body motion from the camera by spring-loaded arms and suspension so that when you move your body, it's not transmitted to the camera, so that you can actually hold the camera, have it be very steady like on a dolly, and move. You can walk, you can run, you can go up downstairs, you can mount it on vehicles. We did a music video for Beyonce called Crazy in Love, where we mounted it on the front of a camera car and went flying down through the streets of Los Angeles, and it takes out all the bumps. It's a great device.
Now, would a really alert, experienced moviegoer know when they're looking at a shot that was shot by a Steadicam?
They may or they may not, depending on how well we do it. You know, sometimes it's just the way the camera moves that you can't It couldn't move in any other way.
Okay. And when you see a production that utilizes the shaky camera technique, sorry, that's an insider term. I'll explain it
yes,
to you later. we're not looking at a Steadicam, right?
No. Well, okay. You could be. I mean, people could take it
you could
and shake
be,
it.
And shaking it, okay.
But it tends to want to not, it wants to override those actions.
Okay. Director David Lynch is a big admirer of yours. You provided a testimonial video when you won the Steadicam Guild's first Lifetime Achievement Award. Here's a bit of what he had to say about you.
I've seen Dan run backwards carrying a Steadicam faster than most human beings could run forward carrying nothing.
Yeah, another parchment.
Can you think that's high praise? Can you think of examples we might remember from a David Lynch film that you shot running backwards?
Oh, well, I mean, there's several films. The opening of Wild at Heart, it wasn't really running backwards. It was sort of running sideways down the stairs with Nicolas Cage and Diane Ladd. And there was a gentleman that they were having a fight with, and he takes him down to the bottom of the stairs and beats his head into a terrazzo floor. and that was all on carpeted stairs at what was the Elks Lodge, is now a hotel in Los Angeles. Then other examples, well, there's one where we shot on Wild at Heart, and it's the scene of Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern going to the Palomino, which is a cowboy bar in North Hollywood, which is not there, and they go dancing. He has a fight with a punk. Punk says, "That's a stupid jacket." And he goes, "This is a snakeskin jacket, a symbol of my individuality and personal freedom." And we did that whole scene with Steadicam over and over. Well, we did one shot through it. They said, "What'd you get?" I said, "This." They said, "Okay, go back and get what you didn't get before." So we did. We went out and loaded another roll of film in the camera, and we shot it again. And that's what's in the film. It was very limited direction, and we shot it. So, I mean, it's not particularly an instance of running, which I've done a good bit of running with it, but it's the kind of freedom that David would give me when shooting scenes. So
how much does it weigh? It
depends upon the camera. It can get up over 100 pounds, and you have to be able to wear it for 18 hours a day.
Tough physical work. Are you you're still operating a Steadicam?
I stopped 3 years ago.
Okay.
I did it for 28 years.
Okay. Your resume also includes being the A camera operator on movies like Jackie Brown and Phone Booth. The Quentin Tarantino film Jackie Brown was screened on campus last night by the MSU College of Arts and Letters Global Film Series. Is the A camera what it sounds like? Is that the main camera
on a film shoot?
And tell us about your interest in working with students. You're going to be rubbing shoulders with a lot of students here today.
I spend a lot of time coming back to deal with students, you know. I mean, to help students. I went to the University of South Carolina, and I always go back and teach there. I teach at AFI. I teach at UCSB in Santa Barbara. I mean, I go around to a lot of different universities because I remember when I was a student what it meant to me when somebody would come that was actually doing the work and would talk with me. And so I like to come back and give back and help students when I can.
I take it the creation of the Steadicam was really it changed movie making.
Yes.
What's happened since the creation of the Steadicam that compares with that in terms of movie making's evolution?
Well, the Steadicam is one of the biggest things that has happened. The smaller cameras help. There's a device called a Technicrane, which is an extendable crane that is in sections, and you can extend it out or draw it back, depending upon how long you need the armor. You can do Steadicam-like moves on the Technicrane where you can arm out over a space, and they make these cranes up to 50 feet long. And then you can suck back on the crane to make it short so you can draw the camera through the set, and you can still go high or low, or you can mount it on vehicles, or you can hand carry it up into places. But it's a very large device, where a Steadicam is a small one-man device, basically.
A lot of moviegoers were pretty stunned by gravity, just in terms of the movie gravity, but
sure.
In terms of the effects. What did that represent a real expansion of a movie maker's tools in your view?
Well, it's a different sort of thing. It's like movies now are becoming computerized.
Mm-hmm.
Gravity was mainly shot with sets that weren't there. If that makes any sense,
they've gone from analog to digital in a way.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, definitely, most definitely.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. How did you break into the business? And what advice might you have for somebody who wants to get into cinematography? Who was a young person?
Well, back when I was doing it, I started shooting news for WIS Television in Columbia, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
I drove around the truck with a little dish on top, you know, and we could shoot 45 miles of that dish, and they told us every time we turned it on, we lost a kid. You know, so I started out doing that, and then I went to Steadicam school. Garrett Brown had the Steadicam school in Miami, and I took that Steadicam school, and almost immediately, since it was so early on that not many people knew how to do it, and the North Carolina film business was just starting up, and so I got into the North Carolina film business, and I did six movies or so for a guy named Earl Owensby in Shelby, North Carolina, and then at that time, Dino De Laurentiis had set up a studio in Wilmington, and I started hitting on them. And the first movie they offered me was one called Blue Velvet, and I said,
"Oh, yeah."
I said, "Sure, I'll do that." You know, and I didn't know what the movie was, but I knew David Lynch because we'd seen Dune, and my friends and I were like, "Boy, he's really pretty interesting. If we could work with anybody in the movie business, it would be David Lynch." And then I get that, and I couldn't sleep at night. I was like staring in the mirror all night.
But can a young person take that same kind of path that you took?
I think that path is different now. I mean, what I recommend to a lot of people is if you can get a job in a rental house, learn the camera equipment, and meet the people that come through that actually make the movies, then that's one path. The other one is to get a job on a film that comes through as a production assistant, and then you can see all the different jobs that are done, and you can see which area might interest you, because there's a million jobs on a film set that you might want to do, and the hard thing is deciding which area you want to focus on.
Oh, I can't get over the number of serious movie directors these days who started out coming up through music videos.
Yeah,
so it's really amazing. Is that a viable approach to getting into the movie business as a cinematographer?
Well, anyway is a good way if you can, but they don't make as many videos and commercials as they used to.
Okay.
I mean, MTV used to show a lot of videos, and there used to be quite a few videos going on. But now, you know, I'm not saying don't make them. I'm just saying the outlets are
there are fewer opportunities.
Yes.
How much does a cinematographer interact on the set with the actors?
A lot. It depends on the job. But, I mean, from my job, either as a camera operator or as a DP, I interact with the director and the actors directly quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to do your job without doing that. So,
Who would you like to work with most that you haven't worked with?
Oh, that I haven't. I mean, David Lynch is my favorite director of all time.
Well, you've been lucky.
Yeah, and then I've done two movies with Quentin Tarantino. Let me think of who would be. I mean, that's really a hard one to pull out of my hat because
okay.
There's a lot of different folks that I have worked with over the years, and I mean I photographed De Niro, you know.
In what?
In Jackie Brown.
Okay. Oh, Jackie. Oh, of course. Well, we want to thank you for joining us here today. This has been really interesting. Cinematographer Dan Neese has been our guest, a longtime Steadicam operator extraordinaire. He's worked on a number of David Lynch films, and he's here for a cinematography workshop for MSU Film Studies students here at WKAR later today. Continued success, Dan. Thank you.
Right, thank you. Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR, where we are enjoying the music live of pianist Ralph Vodopek, arguably the most renowned musician here ever to call East Lansing home. And we're honored to have him as our first performer on our newly restored 1936 Steinway Model S piano here in Studio S at WKAR. We'll be talking with Ralph Vodopek a little bit more later this hour, coming up really in just a few minutes. Michigan's failing schools will be expanding future turnaround efforts by collaborating with various partners, not just the state's disputed Education Achievement Authority. That became clear on Wednesday when State School Superintendent Michael Flanagan informed the EAA its exclusive contract to oversee turnarounds will end in a year. Flanagan's decision comes amid a pointed debate over the EAA's performance since it took control of 15 of Michigan's worst-performing schools in 2012. Now, some EAA supporters admit the authority is off to an imperfect start, but say that its work needs to continue. More vigorous supporters, mostly Republicans, want to expand the EAA from 15 schools in Detroit to dozens more statewide. Critics, which include Democrats and some Republicans, cite a number of concerns, including a lack of transparency in data and administrative chaos. For his perspective on the EAA discussion, we welcome back to Current State the president of the Michigan State Board of Education, John Austin. Hi, John.
Hi, Mark.
The State Board in January announced its support for a turnaround framework that would include more than just the EAA. Did it surprise you that Superintendent Flanagan took this action?
No, this was actually we're consistent with what we were recommending as a board and what we had agreed with Mike Flanagan, our superintendent, made sense. We want to have effective school turnaround efforts. We do have a set of schools that, despite interventions and technical assistance, just aren't making headway and kids aren't learning. But we want to have a quality control, meaning we want educational entities that are effective at turning around schools or have a good track record of educating kids and create some additional options of who those folks might be. So what we were calling for was let's set some clear criteria that we can set for what kind of educational entities, whether it's an ISD, neighboring school district, another public school or public entity, could be a nonprofit or a good charter network, those entities might qualify to absorb some of these failing schools and do a good job with them. And we want it based on whether they have a good track record and whether they have a likely prospects that they're going to be effective. And that then is governs what our perspective on the EAA. The EAA, as you know, got off to a rocky start and lots of debate about its effectiveness, and clearly is not ready for expansion now. It still may prove itself to improve education and outcomes for kids, but what we're basically saying and what Mike's action helped implement was let's give it some more time to see if it's working or not, and if it's not working, it shouldn't get any more schools. If it proves to be working after another year, it might be a candidate for additional schools when it's ready and when it's got its act together.
Why is it not ready for expansion now?
Well, because I think you've seen, and we've seen, lots of both issues and concerns about transparency, about teacher and staff turnover, about I'm not as concerned about the learning model. I think they're trying to implement a decent learning program of individualized instruction. These schools are hard to intervene in and be effective in. They were really among the most challenged, chaotic learning environments. The EAA, as it has gone to work in some schools, I think in some places, as I've heard, they're making some headway, and others, there's been a host of problems and turnover and issues of whether they're channeling, you know, not treating special ed kids and sending them out, and lots of, obviously, complaints from some of the teachers. They did bring in, I think, a little too heavy Teach for America students to rely on those young people, which is different and perhaps not as effective as helping existing teachers be part of a collaborative turnaround effort. So it's a work in progress, clearly, and it may not work. We don't know what works, and we're not alone. Other states with turnaround districts, whether it's the one in New Orleans that a lot of people talk about or others, it's a mixed bag, because it's really hard to take a school and turn it around and create the kind of learning environment where kids are succeeding. If it was easy, we'd have that silver bullet, but we don't.
Chancellor Covington denied Superintendent Flanagan's request to terminate the contract immediately, so it's on hold for 1 year. What's happening there? Why wouldn't Dr. Covington agree to terminate the contract immediately?
Well, I don't know why he responded that way. I do know that I think everybody, including those of us who would like to help the EAA to succeed, and it may not be possible, but we would like to help it to be successful, just as we'd like all of our school turnaround efforts to be successful, would agree that it's not ready to take more schools. And so everybody is happy, I think, to not place any more schools in with the EAA, I would imagine including the EAA, because they need more time to show that what they're doing is effective and to simmer down, if they can, some of the controversies and to prove that they're operating clearly, transparently, with good information coming out, working collaboratively with their teachers. If that proves not to be possible or it just doesn't happen, then, you know, this is a failed experiment. But as I said, no school turnaround effort or learning program is easy, and I think, you know, from our point of view, the jury's still out on whether the EAA can succeed or not. And that's basically what you referenced in terms of our encouragement to legislature was help us get some more options that are going to be of quality, that have a good chance or a good record of school turnaround, including other educational entities, so that we can move more schools into the hands of institutions and efforts that are likely to succeed. And let's let the EAA cool its jets for a while and get out of the spotlight, in the sense of get down to seeing if they can help the kids learn, make progress, and report back in a year.
We're talking with the president of the State Board of Education, John Austin, about the Education Achievement Authority. John, contractually, though, how much control does the EAA have over school reform?
Well, when it was created last year, the superintendent entered into that agreement, assuming it would be the vehicle for beginning to take failing schools and turn them around.
How did you feel about that?
Well, at that time, I was probably not as happy as I would have been if we'd done what we should have done then, which is put some criteria out there for a variety of educational entities that are candidates for school turnaround. And partly we want to prevent more failing schools be turned over, as was the case when the financial crisis hit Highland Park, to charter operators who don't necessarily have a good track record of educating kids, like the Leona Group.
So right now, John, the EAA has total control over.
Well, with this agreement, with this contract agreement that was made between the superintendent and the EAA rescinded, that will allow us to place other entities. And our superintendent, under the law, the school reform office has the ability to place schools with other educational entities, and we just need to make sure that we're not placing more schools with the EAA till it proves itself. And I think that's what, in fact, is going to be accomplished by this, and we're going to see some other entities be able to begin to work with failing schools and hopefully do so in a way that's successful. But there's no guarantees. I mean, these are schools that are hard to turn around, and some of them probably should be shut down and replaced with a new school that is off to a fresh start. And that's something we've got to be serious about in Michigan.
That contract, though, was for 15 years. Given the doubts about the EAA, was the 15-year contract? How did such a long contract get signed that involved such an untested kind of entity?
Well, part of the problem from the get-go was that a well-intentioned EAA, a school turnaround district, which we need, that is going to work with schools. It looked to be codified, to change it from this rather, it's a formal agreement, but sort of informal status of a relationship between Eastern Michigan and the schools, and put into legislation what this school turnaround district would look like. When that legislation was proposed in lame duck legislature last year, it wasn't only about taking 15 schools and turning them around or replacing them. The original legislation had all sorts of additional pieces of new school creation. It wanted the EAA to be able to authorize schools anywhere in the state, not just to replace failing schools. It added the EAA as a sort of warehouse for lots of school buildings that would be turned over to new school operators, for-profit companies, if other legislation that was tied to was going to pass. So it got tied up in a knot and compromised at the beginning, which began to kind of let the cannon fire rain on it, even before it even got started, deservedly so, because it shouldn't have been tied up in a new school creation plan.
We're nearing the end of the segment. There's one more question I really want to ask. What metrics do you think should be used to assess the EAA's effectiveness?
The same metrics we use for assessing all our schools. Are the kids learning and hitting the marks and making growth on our assessments to meet our standards? And are they moving forward and graduating? We have to use the same standards, the same yardstick to all schools, traditional public charters, cyber, and any that are in an EAA, even as they try to do some good new things like do self-paced learning, which is something all our schools need to help. We need to help them do.
Great discussion. We want to thank our guest, the president of the Michigan State Board of Education, John Austin. John, many thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
Right now, we're going to go back to live music here, performed by our special musical guest here on Friday. That would be Ralph Vodopek. And we're going to hear the Andante by Nikolai Kapustin. Ralph Vodopek.
Thank you.
Michigan State University music professor emeritus, Ralph Votopek, performing live here in Studio S for our Friday Live Music today. Ralph's one of our best-known musicians with a career that includes being the first-ever winner of the Van Cliburn International Piano Competition. Ralph's daughter, Catherine, is a violinist on the faculty at the University of Michigan and associate concertmaster of the Ann Arbor Symphony Orchestra. The Votopeks will perform together Sunday, March 9th, in a benefit to help Lansing Catholic High School raise money for construction of a chapel and renovations that will include the school's music classroom. That concert will be at the St. John Student Center on MAC in East Lansing. And joining Ralph Votopek with us today, Gene Morgan, Director of Development at Lansing Catholic High School. Welcome to both of you.
Good to be here.
That sounded fantastic. It's such a treat to have you here.
I'm a frustrated jazz pianist.
Okay. I don't know how frustrated.
I can't improvise, but this is all written out note for note, and so I enjoy playing his music.
What do you make of our new instrument here?
Well, it's a Steinway.
Okay.
Need I say more?
Nothing more needs to be said?
No, it's a fine piano. It's small, but it's very good for its size.
Well, we're delighted to have you with us here today, Ralph. Gene, we want to make sure we learn about this benefit concert. March 9th, this is with Ralph and his daughter Catherine Votopek. The school's raising money for a new chapel and other renovations. Tell us more.
Yes. We're first of all very honored to have the Votopeks come forward and agree to do the concert for us on March 9th. And I will point out that Ralph's daughter, Catherine Votopek, who will be very much part of the concert, is one of our alumnuses. And we're very proud of her and her accomplishments. And the Heritage 2 campaign at Lansing Catholic High School is about the performing arts, the renovation of the auditorium, the music classroom, the practice rooms. So it's very much the heart and soul of the community at Lansing Catholic. And we do have a strings band, we've got jazz band, and in addition to a marching band and choir, honors choir. So these areas get a workout, but it's also very wonderful to have the Votopeks become a part of this and great mentors for the students. So we're really pleased with that.
Ralph, I'm thinking the high school years in particular must be critical to the formation of a good, strong musician. And you sent your daughter to Lansing Catholic.
No, Catherine had good memories of Catholic Central. Her years there in the early 80s, except maybe for gym class, she said. And there wasn't too much music going on in those days, and so they went to summer camp at Interlochen, and her and her two brothers. But I hear things are better now at Catholic Central. It was a very good high school then. I hear it's better now. We're very happy to do this benefit.
Were your teen years, I assume they must have been really, really eventful in terms of your development as a player?
Well, in Milwaukee, the public schools had orchestras, and being a pianist was no place for me in an orchestra, and so I took up the cello for 4 years.
Oh, okay.
And so I played the cello, but I always say I gave it up because my beer kept slipping off.
Okay.
With the piano, there's no problem. I'm from Milwaukee.
Between now and the March 9th benefit concert, Ralph, you're also part of the MSU College of Music Joanne and Bill Church West Circle Concert Series show. This is next Friday the 28th, called Chopiniana, with the music of, I'm hoping I'm saying that correct, Chopiniana, with the music of Frederick Chopin. What will you be playing there?
The fourth ballade of Chopin.
Okay.
The big piece. And the F-sharp major nocturne.
Okay.
But it's just part of the program. This is I play so often on campus, and I can't think of how long it's been since I played with Catherine here in East Lansing. It's been at least 7, 8, 9 years. And so this is a big deal for us, this benefit concert, because that's special. When I play, and sometimes my friends say, oh, I'm sorry I missed your concert last week. I will just, don't worry, I'm playing next month.
tell us more about Lansing Catholic High School's music program. Do you cover... You've got a choral program, I take it, here. How far and wide does it go?
We do plan even a trip every other year to the East Coast, usually New York City, where they take in some concerts, but then at the same time they get to, you know, to mentor some of the artists. So we're really working to grow that program. And so to me, it's kind of in the infancy or maybe the toddler years where we've defined a lot, several different programs and are growing them out. And the strings band will actually be performing the opening number for the benefit concert on Sunday, March 9th, beginning at 2:30 at St. John Student Center. So it's quite an honor for them to get to perform with such a high-level artist in, from the community and from our, you know, from University of Michigan as well. So we're very pleased with that.
Ralph, did you harbor any desire for Catherine to become a pianist instead of a violinist, or were you happy that she pursued a career in music at all?
Well, my wife's a fine pianist, as most people
know.
That's
right.
And so
That's right.
We didn't want another pianist in the family. And so we guided the boys to Paul to clarinet, Mark to cello, and Catherine to violin. And it's sort of a miracle they all became professional musicians because, fathers are generally suspicious, are worried about their children going into such a precarious profession. But it's turned out. Like I say, it's a miracle, and I attribute it mostly to my wife.
Well, they did not
because she encouraged them. And I discouraged them. Therefore, they were not overly encouraged, and they were not totally discouraged.
You discouraged them?
Well, I was worried, you know, especially the boys going into music, classical music. But it's turned out very well. Paul's been principal clarinetist, Naples Philharmonic for 3 years, and Mark teaches at University of Arizona, cello.
Okay. Well, we want to remind our listeners once again, Sunday, March 9th, the Votapex, Ralph and his daughter Catherine will perform together in a benefit to help Lansing Catholic High School raise money for construction of a chapel and renovations that will include the school's music classroom. Ralph, you're going to take us out here with another piece. We will thank you once again for joining us here today on Current State. Ralph Votapek, along with Gene Morgan, Director of Development at Lansing Catholic High School. Thank you, Gene.
Thank you.
That is our show for today. Coming up next week on Current State, we'll speak with the 1491s, a Native American artist collective known for their funny and satirical YouTube channel. Also, we'll preview the Tigers season with Dan Dickerson. That and more next week on Current State with a bunch of great substitute hosts. I will be ice fishing in the Dominican Republic, and I will see you the following Monday. In the meantime, pianist Ralph Votapek from Studio S on Current State.